Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear all arguments from petitioners in General Motors Corporation versus Sam Chase.
May it please the court. Ms. Leslie Landau will present arguments for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This is my first time arguing in the Texas Supreme Court. I'm honored to be here and thank you for the privilege of allowing me to appear. As the court is aware, this is an appeal from an $8.5 million judgment against General Motors, $4 million of them for compensatory damages, $4.5 million in punitive damages, without any reduction, despite a jury finding of 50% comparative fault based on negligent violation of state law duties that apply to drivers of all vehicles, whether they have defects or whether they don't have defects. The judgment violates Texas law several times over. You can't, under Texas law, disregard a jury's comparative fault finding in this case, much less as a matter of law, based on the rule of the Keene case that we would submit does not apply to this case and really ought not apply in any case. You also can't impose liability on a manufacturer, much less punitive damages, for a risk that cannot, in the nature of physical science, be eliminated, for a design that is as good as any on the road, and in fact safer than one that the Federal Safety Agency has found not defective, and for warnings that, if heeded, would have avoided the accident. The judgment here violates the law and cannot stand. I'm going to talk first about the comparative fault finding, then about punitive damages. I think we'll rest on the briefs on the issue of liability unless
there's Now, is your argument that the product is not defective, or is your argument that the 50% liability on Mr. Sanchez is what you're trying to uphold?
I think the answer to your question is yes. And the reason is I think we're contending both.
Both. Okay.
Clearly the 50% finding must stand. It was error to disregard it. But also this court has required that plaintiffs bear the burden of proving a safer alternative design in order to prove a defect. And there is no evidence in the record of a safer alternative design. But let me get to the comparative fault finding first. The jury found that Pookie Sanchez was 50% at fault in causing this injury. The courts below, however, overruled the jury, found GM 100% responsible despite that finding because the court found, as a matter of law, plaintiff's fault lay only in failing to discover a defect. That can only stand if three things are true. The first thing is that the Keene rule is still the law in Texas. The second thing is that there's no evidence, with all the evidence being viewed GM's way, of any negligence apart from the failure to discover a defect. And the third thing is that the issue is not waived. Any one of those, if it's not true, requires that the judgment be reversed and rendered for General Motors on the issue of comparative fault. And we submit that none of those three is true. First, as to the Keene rule, this court held in Keene that, quote, the failure to discover or guard against a product defect is not a defense against strict liability. Now, that rule is a relic of a bygone contributory negligence era. The source was 402A of the Restatement of Torts from back in 1968, comment N.
But how do you respond, the response of the Sanchez's to this argument is, well, if you look at the restatement third, its comment says that by eliminating the comment, it's not intending to say that a plaintiff is somehow responsible for failing to have discovered the defect.
Well, with respect, that's not at all what the third restatement says. What the third restatement says is that all conduct by the plaintiff that violates the duty of care is considered, including a negligent failure to discover a defect. Now, the third restatement says, and it's true, that probably, in most cases, the failure to discover a defect won't be found negligent. But the third restatement leaves it to the jury to decide. And that is just as clear as can be. It says that the plaintiff's conduct fails to conform to generally applicable rules establishing appropriate standards of care. And the restatement makes it very clear that it's up to the jury to decide whether or not.
If the legislature, in adopting Chapter 33 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, in fact, by putting that in Texas law, changed the law, is there any need for this court then to go into any discussion of whether or not Keene still is the law?
Clearly not.
Well, is your position, I'm a little bit unclear, is your position that you're asking the court to change the common law, or that the legislature has already done it and we've just never had the opportunity to acknowledge that?
Well, in a sense, it's both. The legislature has said in very clear terms that any kind of conduct that violates the standard of care is to be considered. To the extent that that supersedes Keene.
Well, does it or doesn't it?
We would submit it that it does. The plaintiffs obviously dispute that.
The only case that's done, there's a Fifth Circuit case that's acknowledged that.
That is correct.
But none of the courts of appeals in this court have not looked at the question.
That is right. And, of course, that will answer the question because it's up to the legislature to decide that, and that would trump the common law. But if there were a question about it, and it were a question that this court could consider under the common law, we would submit that the underpinnings for Keene, that contributory negligence rule, is gone. And the ALI has made it very clear that the reason the second restatement that the court adopted did that is because the Institute, and I'm quoting, was reluctant to bar a plaintiff's product liability claim in tort based on conduct that was not egregious. Thus, Section 402A, comment N, altered the general tort defenses by narrowing the applicability of contributory negligence. Now, what has happened since then? This court adopted, well, contributory negligence is no longer the law. It's now comparative fault. In Duncan, this court made clear that the comparative fault law applies to strict liability as well as to negligence and any other cause of action. And so therefore, the underpinning of Keene is just gone. Now, Justice Phillips recognized that even when Keene was adopted and said that the continued retention of a rule which allows a plaintiff to recover full damages even though conceivably at fault is inconsistent with comparative fault principles.
So in this case, there's no way that this case would ever be submitted without a comparative fault question for Sanchez. They just discovered him with the condition of the truck having backed up to him. Apparently the evidence is that it's because of this, he didn't get it into park, and they allege it's a defect. And that's all that's necessary to get on the part of the manufacturer an instruction to the jury or a question to the jury on whether or not the user of the product failed to discover, was negligent in failing to discover this defect.
Well, I think that's not quite right because there was a lot more evidence than just his failure to discover a defect. For example, and this is why ultimately the Keene
Well, he didn't put it into park. Clearly he didn't put it in park.
But there's more. He didn't set the emergency brake. Texas law requires you to set the emergency brake when you leave the car. He didn't kill the engine. Texas law requires you to kill the engine.
That's what I'm saying. In this case, it's always, for all the reasons you say, the fact that it moved, it wouldn't have moved if the brake was set, it wouldn't have moved if the others were set, and because of that, then this case will always have a question on comparative negligence.
And well, it should. And
just from the fact that the car rolled back against him.
Well, the fact that it rolled back, that's right, it rolled back against him, and there was an emergency brake that would have averted the accident, even if he had misshifted, there's an emergency brake that would have worked. I think that if there was an emergency brake that didn't work, the fact that he didn't pull it up wouldn't have mattered. But here, there was clear testimony by the plaintiff's own experts that the emergency brake worked, it would have stopped this accident from happening. That killing the engine would have stopped this accident from happening. So all of the things that Texas law requires under statute, that the plaintiff's expert, or one of the plaintiff's witnesses, the police officer, made clear any prudent person would have done, were not done. And that the warnings told him to do were not done. In that setting, of course, it should be an issue for the jury, but it is a jury question. And all we're asking for is that the jury's verdict on that question be respected. So that I think that the evidence in this case is ample that there is negligence, or at least a jury could find negligence, that is separate and apart from any failure to discover a defect. Because those duties apply whether the car is defective, whether it's not defective. Those duties would apply even if the plaintiff's own expert's design, if it existed, if it worked, were in that car, those duties would still apply.
Even if everything you say is true, factually, isn't the most this court could do would be to remand to one of the two courts below for sufficiency?
I don't think that the court would need to remand for a sufficiency review because the jury verdict was disregarded based on a finding of no evidence.
But the
if this court finds that there was evidence, then the remedy is to remand with instructions to enter judgment in accordance with the jury's verdict. There's no need for any further review beyond that. There's no cross appeal. There's no other issue.
So we allow parties to make their best legal point first, and if for some reason that didn't prevail on appeal, lesser included points are, can be deemed, I guess, under the Southwestern Bell case, 1989.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
We will deem a less favorable point that a party could have made but didn't make because they thought they had a very favorable legal point. And if we did that, this court does not have jurisdiction to enter the judgment that you request.
Well, I think that ultimately the judgment we request is a reversal and rendering on all points for General Motors. And let me get to the punitive damages point, and then if the court has questions about the liability point, I'll explain to you why that is the case. The court here imposed punitive damages against General Motors because it knew of a risk that couldn't be avoided. Even though it avoided it better or as well as anyone else, any car on the road, and better than a design the Federal Safety Agency said was met the need for motor vehicle safety and was not defective. And we would submit that's a really monstrous result. If that's the law here, then the Moriel case and its limitations go out the window. In every mischief case, there is necessarily a risk of punitive damages liability because if you impose punitive damages for the best design, necessarily you're going to impose them for all designs. And even the plaintiff's own expert's design, which he admits can be misshifted, and which he admits could roll on an incline like this, and therefore cause injury, would subject him to punitive damage. That's crazy. That is really crazy. So let's talk about what Moriel requires. There's two components. There's the objective component, which is an extreme risk, and there's a subjective component, which is an actual subjective awareness of the risk, but conscious disregard of safety. Now, that objective component, let me talk for just a moment, back up for a minute, talk about what is the risk we're talking about. Necessarily, it cannot be the general knowledge of physics and the risk that there is, of necessity, as a matter of physics, a midpoint between park and reverse. And so, therefore, always, in any automatic transmission design, a risk of mischief. If that is the knowledge that matters, then every manufacturer is responsible every time that the inevitable happens. And you can't be punished for knowing the inevitable and not being able to avoid it. So that fact alone cannot justify punitive damages. There has to be a particular risk with this design.
There's one thing that doesn't make sense here. You make it sound as though it's going to be inevitable, that there's going to be a misshift. I've put my car in park for decades. I've never had a misshift.
I think that proves probably better than anything else that the objective risk here is infinitesimal. I've done the same. Probably everybody else here has done the same unless they use a standard transmission. The fact is that there is a 1 in, I think the record says, 19 billion risk in
so
any particular shift that this could happen.
Why did you say it's inevitable?
Because it is inevitable. If you shift a car for 19 billion years, 19 billion shifts, one time maybe in 19 billion, it can happen. The odds against it are huge. And the reason the odds against it are huge is because the manufacturers have designed very good designs. They have a point that's 10 thousandths of an inch or 30 thousandths of an inch. I mean, the likelihood of positioning it, especially when you're not intending to, you're intending to get it to park. There are springs that help you move it there. There's all this technical stuff that keeps you, in all these years of shifting, from ever hitting that midpoint. It's kept me from doing it. It's kept everybody from doing it. It kept Pookie Sanchez from doing it after 86,000
miles. But your argument here, as you did your overview on the sufficiency of the liability proof as well, seems to ask us to do the weighing of the evidence. Consider the evidence that GM put on that was favorable to its position. And there's no question that there were disputed issues in this case and that GM as well put on a case. But you're here on a legal sufficiency point on both liability and gross negligence that requires us to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. So isn't the question, was there a failure of proof on the part of the plaintiffs on these issues, as opposed to asking us to reweigh what case was presented to the jury by both parties?
I'm not asking for any reweighing. You're right, Your Honor. The question is whether there's any evidence, and the answer is there's none. There is no evidence.
In what way, then, did the proof fail?
Well, let's start
as opposed to what the countervailing proof was.
Okay, let's start with the magnitude of the risk. This court in the Universal Services versus Ung case held that a remote possibility of an injury, even a serious injury, is not sufficient. There is no evidence that a misshift of the 700 R4 transmission, the one at issue in this case, is likely. There's one case that has ever occurred in this record. Plaintiff has identified one case of misshift in all the history of the 700 R4 transmission.
Well, their brief talks about several cases, right?
With respect, Your Honor, that's wrong. Okay. There was a question that was asked of GM statistical witness. Do you know of this case and this case and this case and this case? And his answer, no. There's no evidence those cases ever existed. There's no evidence those cases were similar, that it was this transmission. There's no evidence at all with respect to that. And the court is well aware that a question of the lawyer is not evidence. And so there is no evidence of any other case other than the Wagner case. So there's one case. It's undisputed that there are millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of these cars out there. One other case. The Universal Services versus Ung case says one other case does not prove a likelihood of injury. And we would submit that that's the case. So even if the risk is an extreme risk, and we would agree that a misshifted car is dangerous, but the likelihood of a misshift is infinitesimal. It's never happened to anybody in this room. It doesn't happen to virtually anybody who has ever driven, except Mr. Wagner in one case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready for your argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Ms. Rebecca Hamilton and Ms. Loretta McVay will present argument for the respondent. Ms. Hamilton will open for the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court. I'm Rebecca Hamilton and I represent Candy Sanchez. Mr. McVay to represent Candy Sanchez, that I have discussed before argument dividing so that I would address the Keene issue and any liability issues with respect to punitive damages issues, so obviously we're both prepared to take any questions the court might have. I was going to begin by addressing Keene, and I do want to focus on that, but I wanted to say very quickly, at the beginning of her opening, Ms. Landau said that there was no evidence of a safer alternative design, and that's not a correct statement of the record, and I want to give the court some record sites on that. They're very brief. I wanted to point out pages 720 through 21, which discuss how the alternative design prevents the general cause of the accident. I have noted in my brief, and I did not bring the record with me, I will go back and double check these sites, but I have page 607 and page 711 discussing how the design is safer for Pookie and for consumers. I also would note that in GM's reply brief, GM concedes that Mr. Tammany's proposed design, every aspect of it is or has been used by the industry, and that this is not a complicated and exotic design. It's basically a modification of existing design. And finally, I would note on pages 613 through 18, Mr. Tammany commented that when Ford made the design change that he recommends here, they had an 85% decrease in misshift complaints. And I think that addresses the issue of safer alternative design. I think it also brings to bear on the claim that misshifts never happen. An 85% decrease in complaints indicates that they do happen. The expert testimony at trial about the chances of being killed as Pookie was in a misshift are 20 million to one is very misleading evidence and would not be sufficient evidence under Havner or Roberts. First of all, that was based on reported fatalities, and the expert testified at trial that the very database he was using did not report either Pookie Sanchez or Mr. Wagner's injuries. Furthermore, I noticed that counsel did not mention the Masaki case out of Hawaii, which her co-counsel, Mr. Heilbrun, argued in law, which was a virtually identical case to this one. It is correct that these cases are rare, and that's certainly a good thing. but that doesn't mean that they are so rare as to be de minimis and for us to just turn our face away from Cookie Sanchez and say, hey, luck of the draw.
Well, go ahead.
You do agree that there was only one other case mentioned in the record, Mr. Wagner?
I agree with that.
The opposing, your co-counsel says that there were a number of other cases, but those were just in the questions to a witness.
That's correct, and Ms. Landau is correct that an attorney's question obviously does not constitute evidence, and we don't contend that it is. I also would add, following up on what Justice Hankinson asked, I do mention in my most recent reply brief that there are several reported cases around the country of misships. Obviously, and I state this in the brief, they are not all GMs, they are not all 700 are transmissions. I simply stated that because GM has taken the position that a misship in and of itself is an almost impossible occurrence. But GM admits that the transmission designs are all remarkably similar, and these misships do occur. And this is not a plaintiff's boondoggle. These are real cases.
What is the evidence concerning the probability of a misship? And let me cast it this way, and that is, an argument could be made that a product was manufactured so that only one out of every, let's say, 500 million shifts is there going to be a misship. And if that's the case, why would this be a dangerous product?
I appreciate that question, Your Honor, and it is something I did address in the reply brief. And what I would say is, first of all, the plaintiffs did not put on any affirmative evidence of the frequency of these accidents. Now, it is true that General Motors put on a statement by their expert Wecker, I believe, that it's a 1 in 20 million chance that it is less likely than lightning. And what I commented on is that in a product liability case, and this will dovetail into the key issue, in a product liability case, the issue is the safety of the product. And balanced against that, the cost in reducing the harm. A human being knows that to be hit by lightning is so rare, and yet if there's a storm, we will do things to avoid being hit by lightning. And it's not because we're irrational. It's because what we need to do is so slight relative to the harm that we risk. We do those things. And by the same token here, Mr. Tammy testified that for less than a penny, the angle on the detente, on the rooster cone, could be altered so that it could not shift into power again. And my final observation about that, Justice Abbott, and perhaps this is more of a lawyer's observation, is that if these accidents are so inconceivable, why has GM spent so much time and so much money working on these issues, studying these issues? Why do they claim now they warned about it? GM has taken the position that they warned of this precise issue. Why would they warn of something as rare as light?
Let me ask you a little about Keene. Assuming Keene is still good law, assuming it hadn't been changed by the legislature and shouldn't be changed in the common law, aren't some of the issues that they are saying are comparative, but something beyond Keene, that is, just failing to discover the defect?
I'd like to address
whatever that. We think about a law that says you step foot out of the car without turning it off. I mean, is those kind of arguments are apart from failing to discover the defect, don't they?
I understand your question. I think it also relates to Justice Enoch's earlier question. At trial, GM took a different position than it's taking now. GM took the position that Cookie Sanchez did not think he was in park. It took the position that he intentionally put the vehicle in reverse and left out of the car. And this sounds ridiculous, but I have the record sites here. I cite the court to page 684, 1301, and 1614. And the idea behind GM's theory was that by putting the vehicle in reverse, it would scare the cows back into the pen, and he could run back there, shut the gate, and run forward. Now, the jury, whether we agree with it or not, rejected that theory. That goes to comparative fault. That theory, if the jury had said, yeah, that's what he did. Pookie was known for that. That theory is outside of the Keene, the comment and exception, because there he is intentionally putting himself behind a moving vehicle that he knows to be in reverse. That's not what happened here. Every single instance, that GM talks about here, Pookie's failures and malfeasances, were acts that were failure to guard and failed to discover this defect. This is not a defect that anyone could find unless you took the vehicle apart. And you can't know not to do things if you don't know the defect is there. The origin of product liability and the common end exception was that it's a buyer's market and consumers have the right to choose, but product manufacturers have superior access to knowledge and skill. GM had access to this information, and it did not tell Pookie about it. Had they told Pookie about it, he could have made an intentional decision to say, you know, there's this defect, these things leap into reverse sometimes, but I'm a busy man, I'm on my ranch. I'm not putting on the emergency brake. I'm not cutting the engine. But he never had that chance.
Putting aside the legal questions related to Keen, though, Ms. Landau has said that if we look at the jury's verdict on the comparative causation, in the light most favorable to the jury's finding, there is evidence that because he didn't put the parking brake on it, he didn't turn the car off, he didn't do all of those kinds of things, that is evidence other than the kind of evidence that Keene says can't be considered, and that would be enough to support the jury's finding. What's your response to that argument?
Your Honor, as an attorney, I got to do something I've never been able to do, and that was cite Paul's and I did cite Paul's decision in the case. It is true that things Pookie did may have constituted negligence in the air, in the abstract, but none of them relate to the harm that ensued because he did not know it had, the vehicle had a chance to move into reverse. I know that GM has characterized various examples of things Pookie failed to do, cutting the, and they limited it to five specific things.
Does he have to know of that exact defect?
If you mean the sharpness of the detent or the type of transmission, as a person, no.
Right. I'll put it in the extreme. There's one chance in 20 million that if I do it the way he did, it will be in a power position. Does he have to know that to make your argument worthwhile?
Your Honor, and I'm certainly not trying to be disrespectful of our argumentative, but I would say, first of all, the one in 20 million claims is made false law. But notwithstanding, I think he does need to know the distinction, and it's an important one. It's one that both Justice Hardberger and, in his majority opinion, and Justice Rickoff and his dissent pointed out, is the issue is not that the vehicle may move. That's not the issue that it may move into power gear. It's one thing entirely for a vehicle to roll into neutral, but it is another thing for, I think, as Justice Rickoff put it, to be off and running. And I think he was entitled to know that, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I appreciate the court's time and attention.
Hey, please, the court. I'm Russell McMaines, co-counsel for respondent, some of the Sanchez survivors. Would like to first deal with, again, the order that basically was argued by the petitioner. The issue of Keene doesn't live, was it killed by the 1987 tort reform statute? Should it be killed today from a policy standpoint? And my answer to all of those is that it does live, it did live, and it lives in this case. And it should not be killed as a matter of policy. It was not killed in the 1987 statute. And I think our position in briefing is very clear with regards to that point. But the argument that is made in regards to the 1987 statute, frankly, there is no legislative history. We filed all of the legislative history there is in the 1987 tort reform statute. There is no legislative history to support the notion that the preservation of comment in Duncan specifically in 1984 was in any way touched by the tort reform statute. The tort reform statute of 1987 was designed to deal with three specific aspects of Duncan, and it did that. And that's what the Montford and Barber article specifically attest to as well. It deals with creating a liability threshold for joint and several liability. It deals with the fact that there is that they will elevate to a bar the comparative responsibility that was recognized as pure comparative responsibility in Duncan. Didn't change what they could consider as comparative responsibility, and no discussion about that anywhere, but rather but they merely elevated it to a bar as opposed to where there was no bar under the Duncan roof. And then third, with regard to the restoration of the right to credit and that election on the part of the defendant. Those are the three things, three modifications of Duncan that were accomplished.
Where did the Fifth Circuit go wrong in Bradshaw then? In Bradshaw, the Fifth Circuit looked at the language of the statute and noted the inclusiveness of the language in the statute on its face to determine that we would look at comparative causation as to all the players.
Where I think the Fifth Circuit went wrong in part was because there was no, they didn't have any analysis with regard to the legislative history. The fact of the matter is that the in any way language that is relied upon was language borrowed from a 1983 proposal that was actually jointly submitted by the plaintiff and defense bar but rejected by the legislature out of committee, and so that it never got to a vote, which was designed to bring in mitigation defenses. That's what the purpose of the in any way language was, and that was what the source was. That's where it came from in the 1987 statute. The Fifth Circuit simply looked at it in the abstract and said, oh, well, that must mean any kind of contributory negligence, including failure to discover a defect.
The language is pretty broad in the statute and very inclusive.
The language does say in any way. The language, however, and interestingly enough, this court in Dresser versus Lee, which in 1995, when this court revisited the issue to some extent and basically said, okay, we're going to assume that comment N and Keene remain accurate, remain the law. And then the court provides prospective rulings with regards to how to handle that trial and says that it's the plaintiff's burden to make that request on an instruction, which is what their argument is with regards to the Weaver issue, which does not apply. There was no such request to Keene either that was reversed on the same grounds that we did in trouble. But the point being that prospectively, the court in 1995 did say this is viable, it's the plaintiff's burden. Why would this court do that if, in fact, the 1987 statute had done away with it? That makes no sense. This court considered that issue in 95 and said we're not going to touch that issue. And one of the reasons is because you don't go around in a consumer oriented notion of products liability law, be it restatement third or otherwise, or the restatement second, and impose upon consumers the obligation to inspect for defects.
Okay, let's follow up on that.
That's right.
What is wrong with there being some evidence before in the trial that the consumer was aware of the defect and in the face of that defect chose to continue using it? You say a duty to inspect, but and maybe that's what...
You get close to the assumption of risk, which was basically wrapped into a notion of comparative responsibility as opposed to a complete law.
Sure, but what is wrong with... It seems to me it's the defect of which the consumer doesn't know, the manufacturer knows, so there's a duty to warn, but it's a defect that the consumer's aware of, and the consumer makes a considered decision to continue working with
the consumer. But the consumer is not aware in this case. The evidence really is overwhelming that...
Well, I don't think there's any dispute that the consumer was aware of this defect. I don't think there's any
aware
dispute.
You mean that he was not aware?
Yeah. There's no argument that he was aware that it would jump out of park or
that's
in a
correct
neutral deal and go into
that's
power.
Correct. And it's the powered reverse movement that there was no warning about whatsoever, no identification of that as being a possibility. This case is very much
similar to the argument here,
though,
here is that you would have been entitled to an instruction if Keene applied, which would be to only consider negligence that's unrelated to knowledge of the defect.
Yes, but there is no negligence unrelated to the knowledge of the defect. And that was the entire point. The point
the court concludes, if the court concludes that there is evidence of negligence unrelated to the knowledge of the defect in the park, then we don't even reach whether we have to reconsider Keene, do we?
If the court can identify what there is evidence of his conduct that constitutes some kind of independent evidence of negligence other than failing to guard against a defect, that is unknown.
If the legislature has passed these laws,
those laws actually don't
apply. They only apply to the highway.
court, I mean, despite their continued insistence they apply, they know absolutely completely that they do not operate ever on private property. These laws do not apply. There is no basis for a negligence per se argument, or even a negligence argument in terms of the legislative standard apply. Clearly, there is a greater capacity and propensity for vehicles to roll on pavement, which is where the public roads are, than there is on dirt, with very little incline, of which the evidence in this case is overwhelming. There was very little incline, and that it probably wouldn't have moved at all had it merely remained in neutral. It's a powered reverse problem and phenomenon that was never warned about, never talked about. And the idea
so you're saying that there, if you're on pavement at an incline, there are bad things that can happen with an unparking braked running engine that simply wouldn't happen if you're on a level dirt road.
Yes.
And there's nothing
correct.
Else. The record in this case would show, after careful review, that there is nothing else that could go bad and cause that car to move other than this defect.
Well,
if one left the car running with no parking brake.
Basically, I mean, other than the fact that it rolls backwards, I mean, that it would roll on an unpowered as opposed to a powered situation, there's no evidence that Mr. Sanchez knew anything about the powered reverse. There's no evidence that they warned about it. There is absolute evidence that they consciously knew about it and chose not to warn about it. The GM knew about that risk. The evidence in this record is overwhelming that, in contrary to, I understand, Your Honor's experience, that this particular vehicle, in fact, was misshifted on a number of occasions. Every time the experts wanted to do it, tried to do it, or even knew where to do it, didn't have any problem at all, could do it and did do it.
Let me ask
happened
you
quite often.
Procedural point before you go on to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
If the court concludes that the trial court should have rendered judgment on the verdict,
That's right.
Do we remand or reverse with respect to that?
You're talking about regards to the Keene issue?
Yes.
I think this court would have the power to render because they do not have a motion for new trial. They didn't have a factual sufficiency complaint, one way or the other. They only made a no evidence point.
Plaintiffs didn't have a factual sufficiency.
And we did not make a cross point at that either.
At any point.
In the court of appeals, that's correct.
Did you in the trial court?
Well, we did have motions in the trial court.
Motions
that's
disregard,
correct.
Though.
That's correct. We did have motions in the trial court, but we did not have.
The reason I was talking softly in question to her, though, vague on the law, but I recall that Justice Mosley wrote an opinion about 10 years ago that if we don't buy your major point, that would get you either all your money or a take-nothing judgment, and there is a lesser point, and I think there was a sufficiency point. There's a lesser point you could have made that
yes,
the court would presume that they would not force parties to make alternative, less favorable arguments.
I understand. There is that, I believe, in the San Antonio case, or in the case out of the San Antonio court.
Mr. McMahon, what evidence do you contend is in the record to satisfy
Oh, you mean in terms of that there is
legal sufficiency on the punitive point?
There is the evidence in the record is that in turn, and we've identified it in our brief. It's much more obviously laid out in there. They're really the GM's own engineers and own experts admitted that they knew that there was a risk of a powered reverse movement. They knew that that was dangerous. That's the unreasonable risk that they chose not to warn about. They knew that there had gone, and there is the example of Wagner as being one of the other deaths. There was interrogation about the fact that there was other cases. They actually had come from other cases. Some of the experts had actually come from testifying from other cases in which they were involved that had involved significant injury.
The significant injury part doesn't seem to be the issue that's being focused on. It's the likelihood requirement of
The likelihood is divorced, in my judgment, in the analysis of the petitioners. From the standpoint of they're arguing that it is unlikely that this will result in a fatality. That's really what their lightning strike evidence related to. As opposed to, it's very likely that mischiefs will occur. It is very likely, in fact, inevitable, that hydraulic neutral cannot be designed out of a transmission that bears this configuration. But that possibly it can be improved with regards, and that's what our argument with regards to alternative safer designs that we produce, that it could be approved and essentially designed out of a powered reverse movement, which is much more dangerous, as indicated by the conclusions of our Chief Justice in the San Antonio Court, in his opinion. And ultimately, the product's third position on this issue is the same as basically what our position is. Is that it is not a question of a manufacturer being entitled to the first bite or the first death or the first injury. If they know of a significant risk, if they know of that risk and they choose not to do anything about it consciously in terms of warning or designing a weapon, they can be found to be grossly negligent.
Well, that leads me to a third element, conscious indifference. And there have been recalls on park to reverse, I believe, from the briefing. I understand there was a lot of evidence in here ongoing efforts
to
redesign. So,
earlier Ford situations, there were recalls relating to the park to reverse. This is a problem that has been around since the 70s.
And aren't there, there are people in all of these automobiles, companies that their job is to work on this and design on it. Is it not? And on the state of that record, is there evidence of the conscious indifference?
Yeah, I believe that there is, because there is evidence that they, in terms of the warnings issue, you see, the problem is they once again say that the inherency of the defect is in the design. And while they were working on alternative patents and other things to design it out of the system, the point is that during this period of time, while it's an inherent risk and an obviously dangerous inherent risk, they consciously chose not to inform the user that this is a problem with powered reverse. There's nothing in their warning that says that there is a risk that it will shift to reverse if you don't do any of these things. There's nothing that identifies that risk. That's classic failure to warn or identify that risk. That's the basis we believe that the jury made the determination that they were consciously indifferent. Their own expert, Dr. Hazard, specifically testified in cross-examination that presumably they know about the inherency of this risk, and presumably if they don't put that in their warning, they did not do so consciously. And that's part of the thread that was argued with regards to the conscious indifference aspect in the charge.
What does the record show concerning the probability of an improper shift in the event that your expert's design was implemented?
Our expert testified that he cannot design out the improper shift, but that with making the modifications that he had recommended, that he believes that would prevent powered reverse movement.
100% of the time.
Yes.
And there's evidence saying it would.
That's what he says. That is his testimony. That it would prevent it. You can design that out of the system. Their response to that, again, was rebuttal testimony about, well, yes, but that's infeasible because if we make it that tough on the system to work that way, then the car may not last as long. There are other types of things they presented in rebuttal testimony, all of which is an invitation, as this court initially noted, to weigh evidence, which I don't believe is an appropriate one.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I want to clarify a few things and answer a couple of questions that the court asked. In fact, there's been no recall before. And if the court looks at the brief, it will see that the Federal Safety Agency said the Ford, which had a mischief problem, a multiple of General Motors or any other manufacturer, did not have a defective condition, in part because it warned to do things like put the car, kill the engine and pull the emergency brake. And in fact, the warning there was not nearly as good as the warning GM gave here. But notwithstanding that, the Federal Safety Agency found that there was no defect. So even with respect to Ford, which had a multiple of the problems that any other manufacturer had, there's no defect. And likewise, the evidence that Ford then improved its design, ironically, the evidence says that it improved its design by adopting 1YTN, but the fact that it said Ford improved on its own dismal record by 85% doesn't say anything with respect to the GM design. So there's no recall. Counsel, with respect, manufactures evidence by citing the Saki case. The Saki case wasn't before the jury, couldn't have been before the jury, because it involved a 1976 van, the 700R Ford transmission. The one at issue here wasn't in cars until 1982. So the Misaki case didn't come in the court, couldn't come in this court, certainly, both because it's post hoc and because it has nothing to do with this design. And in fact, if the citation of other cases with respect to other manufacturers proves anything, it proves exactly what we say, which is that if you can impose punitive damage liability here, then you can impose it in any case, because there is this tiny mischief risk. Now let's talk about the risk. Justice Abbott asked counsel, I believe Justice Abbott asked counsel directly, do you have any evidence, did you put on the evidence of the magnitude of risk in the 700R4 transmission? And counsel says no. That was counsel's burden. That was plaintiff's burden to prove that there was a likelihood. And there was no evidence that in ordinary driving, not an expert trying to get into a position like that, but in ordinary driving, there was no evidence of the likelihood presented by the plaintiff. All there was General Motors evidence, and there's no dispute about the millions of cars out there. There's no dispute that there's only one case that is before the jury, and by the way, it's not a death case, as counsel represented. That Wagner case.
But the likelihood of misshift is so improbable, such that it is one in 20 million occurring. Why did you warn about it?
Well, Your Honor, I think that shows that General Motors, like all the manufacturers, wants to protect safety. It's not conscious disregard for safety. It's regard for safety. Yes, you can't design around it. You can try to warn to do things that will prevent injury from it.
If that's the case, then why did you not warn that it could shift into reverse?
If you look at the warning that General Motors gave, it says it can be dangerous to get out of your vehicle if your shift lever is not full. Magnitude of risk in the 700R4 transmission. And counsel says no. That was counsel's burden. That was plaintiff's burden to prove that there was a likelihood. And there was no evidence that in ordinary driving, not an expert trying to get into a position like that, but in ordinary driving, there was no evidence of the likelihood presented by the plaintiff. All there was General Motors evidence. And there's no dispute about the millions of cars out there. There's no dispute that there's only one case that is before the jury. And by the way, it's not a death case, as counsel represented, that Wagner case. And
but the likelihood of misshift is so improbable, such that it is one in 20 million occurring. Why did you warn about it?
Well, Your Honor, I think that shows that General Motors, like all the manufacturers, wants to protect safety. It's not conscious disregard for safety. It's regard for safety. Yes, you can't design around it. You can try to warn to do things that will prevent injury from it.
If that's the case, then why did you not warn that it could shift into reverse?
If you look at the warning that General Motors gave, it says it can be dangerous to get out of your vehicle if your shift lever is not fully apart. Your vehicle can roll. If you've left the engine running, the vehicle can move suddenly. There's not a lot of evidence on why it's not in there. I can speculate that if you start telling people that it's there, you're going to have teenagers trying to get it there. And that's probably not a good thing. But certainly, General Motors tried to warn. With this warning.
How does
how does the warnings that General Motors give compare to the warnings of other manufacturers?
Well, it's certainly a far better warning than the warning that the safety agency said was okay in Ford. There's not, I don't believe, a lot of evidence about what other warnings are given by other manufacturers. I can tell you that, and this is not in the record, that the warning in the Wagner case was not this warning. It was the predecessor warning. And in Wagner, the jury found a failure to warn, and the warning that the plaintiffs in that case said should have been in the car was this warning. So I don't think there's certainly no evidence in the record of any warning that is better than this warning. And there is evidence that there are warnings that are not as good.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tom. That concludes the argument in this case in both cases this morning. The marshal will now adjourn the court.